This is CliffCentral.com.
All right, here he is, everybody. Stuart Taylor has popped by to see us this morning. How are you, dude?
I'm well, thanks. How are you, dude?
It's nice to see you, man.
It's very nice to be seen so early in the morning.
You're looking healthy and happy and full of joy for someone who's up at this time in winter.
I am, yes. It's the cold. The cold will do this to you, eh?
But you...
Because I'm not used to this Joburg cold.
Yeah,
this is
terrible.
This is something else.
But I hear about this big show that you guys have got going on at Monte Cassino.
Yeah. This coming weekend, it's the Big Five comedy show.
So, Big Five, usually people in Africa who go to see the Big Five, they have to go to the Kruger Park, but this time you can just go to Monte Cassino.
Now you can just come to Monte Cassino to check them out. Yeah. Listen, it's a cool, proudly South African idea. You know what I mean? It's a quintessentially proudly South African.
Listen,
the Big
this
Five.
This is a hell of a lineup, man. There's Flismus, there's Joey Rustine, there's Nick Rabinowitz, there's Jason Goliath. That's a hell of a... It's a power combo.
It's a power combo. That's what we want the show to be. We want it to be a lineup of people that you won't see together, much like the Big Five. It's odd to see this lineup.
The Lion and the Buffalo.
In one go. It's just a bunch of guys who are so busy, which makes it very difficult for us as the producers to try and find a lineup because you're like, oh, okay, cool, we're going to do it, and then suddenly things come
up. I'm amazed by comedians because if you asked me to present like a back-to-back radio show with four of the other biggest, I'd hate that idea. I would hate it because to me it would be competitive and it would be shit and it would be an ego thing. But when you've got guys like you and John Flismus and Joey Rustine and Nick Rabinowitz, Jason Goliath, the weird thing about you guys is you're not actually competing with each other because you're all so different. You have different stuff going on and none of you are threatened by each other. I mean, that I think is amazing.
Well, that's exactly it. I think you kind of get to a point in your career where you're like, yeah, I mean, my style is my style, so I'm going to go and do what I do. I'll do the best. Don't get me wrong. I want to be better than everyone else the night. So there's a little bit of friendly competition.
And there are probably some people who come just for you, and they're like, oh, God, I don't want to see these other oaks.
But the beauty of it is often those are the people who walk out there going, I'm Joey. I don't want to see Joey. And then they watch Joey.
And they love
it. And they're like, oh, wow, Joey does.
I can see why this guy gets so much attention.
Exactly.
Right.
So, you have that sort of cross-pollination of audiences. But I think, everyone is kind of comfy in their own skin. You just kind of feel, no, you want the best show possible. That's what you really want.
So you actually graduated from Stellenbosch in science.
I've got a science degree. Yeah.
What kind of science?
Zoology and animal physiology.
You're kidding me.
Yeah. Yeah. So I never quite used it. Never quite used it because I was doing comedy at varsity. I mean, in the last year of varsity, there were comedy gigs happening all over Cape Town.
I have pegged you down as a zoologist.
A zoologist, man.
That's pretty damn cool.
It is, and just 2 weeks ago, I helped give my friend's dog a pain pill. So I've been using it for now.
All these years of hard work,
and finally,
built
I got
up to you
do
giving
that
pill
that last week.
But dude, I mean, obviously, a lot of people know you from television as well.
Yeah.
You've hosted shows like Going Nowhere Slowly. You've done festivals all over the country. You've done plenty of stand up all over South Africa too. Let's just look at the other TV stuff for a second. Diary of a Touring Comic.
Yeah, that was a fun show we did. It was sort of a behind the scenes look at what it's like to go on tour.
Yeah.
So there was this. I was doing this 6-city tour, and I happened to mention ask one of the TV stations, "Yo guys, come on board as a media partner." And they said, "Well, take a camera crew and shoot it and show us what happens behind the scenes." And so that was a cool sort of 6-part series. And I got into lots of trouble.
Why?
I called Queenstown a shithole.
Oh, I was in trouble just this morning for East London. What is it with the Eastern Cape, though? There's a lot of terrible places.
But it was for TV guys. And then the next year when I called, I was like, hey, yo, so dates? And then they were like, oh, so Stuart wants to come back to the shithole, hey? Sorry, it's full.
Yeah, but
it's full.
You weren't ever going to make like lots of money in Queenstown. They don't have any.
But I was in Grahamstown. I was like, guys, I'm finishing in Grahamstown on the Saturday. Let me pull in on the Sunday and just do the show.
Nah,
no.
How many people live in Queenstown? 400?
Possibly.
How many?
200 employed.
Yeah. This is the thing, right?
100 comedy fans.
Let me show you this quickly. This I got today.
Oh.
Just look at that letter that someone.
Ooh, I see. Gareth's comments on East London. I was sent a clip of Gareth's comments on the Eastern Cape and East London. Wish to express my massive concern at how uninformed his opinion and comments were. Uninformed, Gareth. That is what you are about the Eastern Cape, my friend.
But it's it's a tough place. I mean, there's very little employment there at the moment. It's horrible looking. It's going through all kinds of shit. The governments there, the municipal governments there are like the worst in the country. They're the most corrupt. There's no money.
This it's is me disaster. Desperately wanting to take my shows back to East London, saying, oh, you know, Gareth, yeah. you must give it a second chance, eh?
Okay, I won't. I'm not going to let you get tarred with my brush.
Well, listen, as long as there are cameras rolling, so, I'm going to be like,
I want to go back to Diary of a Touring Comic for a second, because yeah. I think this is such a clever idea. And in South Africa, a lot of people who are fans of comedy, they don't really get to see behind the scenes, and they don't get to understand what it's like, because it's hard work.
It is.
You have to get on planes, you have to get in the car, you have to go from town to town, you have to sometimes play in really lovely areas, lovely places, lovely venues where nice people are, and then sometimes you play in some shithole where everybody's drunk, and they may be all a little bit inbred. You don't know. You could play in some really terrible places.
You might.
And sometimes you get a huge crowd of hundreds, maybe even thousands of people, and you're playing to a massive auditorium, and then sometimes it's just a tiny little crowd.
Yeah.
And you have to treat them the same, right?
Exactly. Well, you take each one by its merits. You don't necessarily go in there with a specific idea that, okay, this is how I'm going to deliver this show. You know what I mean? The one thing I've realized is you got to really take it city by city, town by town, show by show. I mean, I was doing the Grahamstown Festival, and on one day, we were doing a late night show called The Last Laugh. And on one night, it was just a massive riotous 10 comics. You couldn't, everyone who was in Grahamstown was in this venue. It was massive. And the comics went up and killed. Yeah. The comedy gods don't like it that you are too famous. So they kind of pulled the rug out from under you the next day. And the next day, it was just an audience, fairly decent size, but the audience just sat and stared at the acts.
They were dead.
Just death after death after death. It was the thing of, go play the audience in front of you, man.
What if you know you've got a diary, because you probably booked up months and months in advance, right?
But yeah.
So are there certain gigs, are there certain places that you love going to? Are there certain crowds that you just know you're going to have the best time with, and it always turns out that way? And are there some that you are nervous and apprehensive about?
There are. Well, listen, I mean, when you talk about something like the Big Five, which my company produces, because you've got those five big names, you guarantee to have amazing crowds come and watch the show. I mean, as you say, it's not a show you get to watch all the time. Yeah. And also, it's at the theater, man. And you know better
as if that
venue.
Isn't enough, just by the way, they've also got Reddy D, who's going to be DJing.
Wiki.
And yeah, he's going to perform between the changeovers, so they're not letting you have 1 second of being bored.
No. I mean, he does this cool, really massive, impressive opening that happens with a set that flies in and all sorts of things.
He's so good.
He's incredible. Yes. That's always what I say. If you've never seen Reddy D perform, come and watch the show. No, you will have new respect for Reddy D. It's something else. So, I mean, for me, that's something I always look forward to. The other thing I look forward to are those one-man shows, because you can be a little bit more indulgent if it's a one-man show.
Yeah.
That's hour 20 with my people. They came, they bought a ticket. If there are 10 of them, those 10 people came and bought a ticket for me.
Right.
If there's 600 people, they came and they bought a ticket for me. It doesn't matter. You can take your time. You can do material that you wouldn't ordinarily do. There's so much less pressure, because you can kind of have 20 minutes of crazy and just get whip them up into a frenzy and then go, okay, now let me just talk about some things that's on my mind. I want to
ask you, how do you test new material out? Because a lot of guys will go to small comedy clubs, and they'll try it out there.
That's still the best way to do it. Yeah. I mean, Sunday night, I was at the Armchair Theater playing in front of 20 people. It was just that thing. So, and literally, if you want the best value for money, if you're in Cape Town on a Sunday night, go to the Armchair Theater. You'll catch Riyad Musa there. You'll catch Kurt Skunda there. I'm there. We literally, it's like our old stomping ground. And it's a place, you'll see Nick Benoit walk out on stage with a notebook.
Yeah.
And be like, guys, I'm going to be here for a while, eh? Because sometimes you just need to say the words to people in front of you, and you get a sense of what is going to be funny. You can't do it without the audience. And even if they're laughing, if they're not laughing, you go, that's going to work. Ooh, that sounded good when it came out.
That's really tough, though. Gee, people don't know how hard it is. And I know you've been doing it such a long time now, you probably don't screw up anymore.
Oh, no. The screw-ups can happen.
Man, I've seen these young comics who go up there, and they want so badly to succeed.
Yes.
And they just want to make people laugh, and sometimes they miss the boat completely. It's so horrible to see someone die.
It is. But it's That's, you know, when you're really dying as a comic is when you hear no one laugh except for the comics in the back. When you deliver a line and you hear no one else laugh except Loyiso Madinga laughing from the pit of his stomach. You're like,
because he thinks it's funny that you're dying.
Exactly.
He doesn't think you're funny.
No. He thinks it's hilarious.
But are there also like in-house comics jokes, like where you guys are actually trying to crack each other up sometimes?
Oh, absolutely.
And it doesn't even matter what the audience think.
Well, this was the thing on Sunday at the Armchair Theatre. Tatsun Konza was hosting and he was talking about how young the audience is. And Gilly after came up and she was like, okay, well, you guys are not going to get this because I'm too old for you. And then there were moments in my set where I was talking, and when they didn't get it, I just look at Tats and be like, this is exactly what you're talking about there, Tats. They have no idea what I'm talking about in terms of heart transplants. Huh? They don't even know you can transfer a heart.
Because there's obviously a lot of stuff that is, it breaks down by age and, you know?
Yeah. No, it's, I mean, listen, this is the nature of, I mean, so we're talking to a bunch of students.
Yeah.
And I asked them something. I asked them, did you know what, 3rd of December 1967, UCT, they did the world's first? No. And there's a pause, and these UCT students just stared at me like,
and you got Chris Barnard, and they still
blank stares. I was like, heart transplant, guys. Do you know we did the thing? Oh, yeah. Okay. Right. Let's not talk about that then.
Do you think that that's Google's fault because people don't know anything anymore? They have to Google everything.
What do you think that is?
Because that irritates me. I'm like, have a conversation with me where you don't have to check things on the phone. You've got to know some stuff, right?
Do you know what is
weird? I mean, you've got to be clever to be a comedian.
Well, one would hope so. Well, you must just question the world. You must look at issues and then be able
to take a.
It's kind of what they teach you. Yeah, they teach you to think.
I've never met a stupid comedian who made it.
So
the point is that you're a social commentator, all of that stuff too. But you have to be up to date with what's going on. You have to know what's happening in the world. Yeah. And I find like a lot of people are very, very bad when it comes to general knowledge. Not because you're going to enter a competition and win a prize.
No, just knowing what's happening in the world.
That's it. It makes you an interesting person, right? And as a comedian, if you're getting an audience of dumbasses who don't know
it's
very hard to get through to them.
It's very hard. But you know what is weird? I mean, you're asking what is the root cause of it? How strange is it that if you look at our education systems, we have so much more subject matter that kids need to get through nowadays.
Yeah.
They've got to get through so much subject matter.
Yet they seem to come out knowing less.
Come out dumber.
It's
quite something.
Like a factory of stupid.
It is a little bit shame. I mustn't say this. My kids are in that factory.
How old are your kids now?
7 and 10. 7 and 10, yeah.
You know, do you think that they're keeping you young or do you think they're making you old?
I think that they're keeping me back.
Would you have used condoms?
No, listen, I like them a lot. I'm a big fan of them.
You like them?
I'm a big fan of them.
That's good to know.
Yeah, I really do like them. What a relief. They're not assholes. Well, they are, but I mean, in a cool way. I do quite like them, and I think we have good times together, and they keep you grounded.
Are they really funny?
They are. The eldest is very quirky. He's a complete geeky, quirky little dude. Yeah. Kind of reminds me a little bit of myself. The youngest is, like, he's just cool, man. He's just the coolest person I know. He's got his own dress sense. He's just,
wow.
He's got style.
That's
seven years old. And he just says things to you.
I was so out of place at 7 years old.
This guy, we're in a lift the other day. We were about to step into a lift, and then two elderly couple came out of the lift. So, Stuart Taylor, lovely to meet you. My son's a big fan of yours. Mm-hmm. Do you mind if we take a photo? So we take a photo, and then they left, and we got in the lift, and as the lift was moving on, my son just sort of breathed out. He was just kind of leaning back as he does in the lift, just like, it's always nice to meet a fan.
What a cool kid.
I was like, where do you get these words, boy,
but
that
where
you
does
can
he get
say
this
things?
Confidence?
I don't know. Well, he's at one of those schools, I think, which breeds confidence.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Expensive school.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is it?
Yeah. They go to two different schools, so we're getting two very different products.
Oh, you're going to test them out and see
which
one comes out.
We are testing. Well, the one is considered co-ed because he's very much a co-ed little boy.
Yeah.
And the other one is a boy. And he's just complete boy, ragabaga. Come on, boys. Come on.
Is that the younger one?
The younger one, yeah.
Isn't it amazing, though, to see like two kids? They come from the same parents. They are They're raised in the same house.
Same. Everyone's got exactly the same things.
And they're totally their different. Views.
But even their value systems are different. They've got completely different value systems. David, my eldest, is the most grateful person you will ever meet.
Yeah.
If you gave him some lip ice, he'd be like, oh, that's beautiful. Thank you. Is this for me? Are you sure I can have it? And he'll ask you 20 times if you can. My boy, I bought it for you, but for me to keep. That's Andy, if you gave him lip ice, he'd be like, oh, but lip ice.
Where's
the
rest?
These things are, you know, I thought you were going to bring me an iPad, and now you've brought me lip ice. I mean, that's, my lips are dry, but you know.
Are you strict with them about technology?
Because
at that age, like 7, 10, you know, they could be on the iPad all day.
They could be, but thankfully, listen, I mean, my view is this. Tech is a part of the world that they live in now. I cannot compare their lives to my life.
Mm-mm.
They don't even know that television exists.
Yeah, they don't care about
They've
TV.
Never... So, I'm sorry, I was one of those 100,000 that DSTV hemorrhaged.
Oh, you left?
I left.
You don't need them anymore.
I just, because...
Don't be embarrassed.
This is my thing. Oh. So I was like, guys, I'm sorry, you've got to have a better model. My kids don't watch it. It's there for them.
Yeah.
I don't... I'm not... I just don't have the time to watch it. My wife will watch series on
Dude,
Netflix.
I haven't
or
watched,
Showmax or
I haven't watched live TV with the exception of the World Cup now.
Other
than that, nothing.
So this is my thing. So the kids didn't even realize that we'd gotten rid of DSTV. They consume YouTube.
Mm-hmm.
And they consume what they want to consume. And I'm like... So their world is completely different to my world. So I think we can't have the same rules. I also think that David is going to be, it's his world. It's really, it's how he communicates. He's a very shy little boy, but in that world, he's got 8 friends and they're a little network and they play games online that's their vibe. And that's cool. Andy's very different. Andy play with the iPad for half an hour and then he's bored and he's outside.
When I was a 10-year-old nerd, I had to go out and meet. It was very anxiety provoking, you know.
And that's the space where Dave is. And so we find Dave uses his iPad as a tool to communicate with people.
Right.
So he'll take it with him to a party and he'll show other kids and other kids. He's proficient in it. Whereas Andy's proficient in kicking a ball, so people are going to think he's cool because he can kick a ball.
Yeah.
So you'll gravitate to those people. Dave is terrible at kicking a ball. So I'm like, yo, boy, so take your iPad and show them that you're cool.
Yeah, again, it's so cool that they're so different because then they're not going to compete with each other either.
No, completely. Not at all.
Do they appreciate you being, you know, a famous comedian? Are they totally aware of it? Like you said, your son in the lift went, oh, it's always nice when you meet a fan. But...
I don't think he knows what that means, though. No, he doesn't know what that means. Like, his friends at school or people at his school tend to know me.
Okay.
So they'll be like, oh, we saw your dad on whatever show. Or we saw your dad.
Have they ever heard your stand-up?
They have, but without any interest at all.
Really?
At all. So Andy, for example,
people are paying to see you and your kids.
Yeah, and they're just sitting at the back there like, is there more popcorn?
Yeah, they don't care.
The slushy is finished. Can I get another slushy? They really only come for the popcorn and slush.
Little shit.
But Andy will be that dude. So he'll be like, if we're designing a set or something, Andy will be a part of it. So I'll be in the garage. I'll make a mock-up of the set because I'm really hands-on when it comes to the shows.
Wow.
So I'll be like, oh, this is what I want it to be, and I'll get a buddy of mine in Grant, and we kind of stay with wood and whatever, and we're going, so if we did this, and we can kind of, I can say to a set designer, yo, this is the idea. But Andy's there. Andy's hammering and nails and screwing in things, and then when he sees the end product, he's like, yeah, that's the thing we made.
So you actually do that stuff when it comes to the production. I mean, you mentioned your company just now.
Yeah.
You guys are doing this Big Five comedy show. So you design the set.
Absolutely. Everything. I mean, and this is why it's my baby. The Big Five is really... Where it started was maybe about 3 or 4 years ago. I started traveling outside of SA. Whenever I do it,
you've done Montreal, you've done Edinburgh, you've done all of those.
I remember I was in New Zealand, and it was for the New Zealand Comedy Festival's 21st anniversary, and I was the first South African to be on the festival. And what they were saying, they were talking about how it's now a truly international festival. It was always the idea of, if you have an international festival, you've got to have British comics, Australian comics, American comics.
Yeah.
And so now, for them, it was really interesting. Oh, and now we've got someone from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, that's a very interesting thing, that we see it in that way. We go, there's British humor, there's American humor. Also, Australians have got their own twist on things. is there a South African or an African voice?
Mm-hmm.
And whenever I talk to people who travel, a Tatsin Konzo or a Lois Ogola, they're going, there's very much an appetite for what South African, not African comics necessarily, but what South African comics have got to say. They seem to be tempered in a different way. It seems to be this new pillar of comedy in the world, that's is fantastic. Something else.
That's very good.
It's amazing. Now, my question is, how do you then take that pillar into the world? And this is where the Big Five stems from. I was like, well, what if we did? Because traveling on your own, it's quite a lonely thing, and you just never feel like you. So you go, and then I'm in Montreux in Switzerland, and that's lovely, and you do a gig there, and it's beautiful, and they say, wow, well, it's amazing. We must do African comedy.
Did the Swiss laugh at anything?
They smile at you. They smile. they smile and then bring you some chocolate.
Anything controversial has happened there years.
No. But they do have the biggest comedy festival on mainland Europe. Montreux. Yeah, Montreux.
Like
2 weeks after the jazz festival, because the jazz festival is massive. And then they bring in the big comedy festival. And it's, in fact, myself and Kagiso Lediga, Loy, Gola, and one more, two or three other people. We were the first sort of English-speaking, because it used to all be French.
Yeah.
French-speaking comedy. So they were like, oh, let's get English-speaking comic. And this was an interesting thing from people who are in the world, because they curate festivals around the world, these guys. And they were saying, well, if we're going to have English-speaking comics, let's not get the Americans and the Brits and the Australians. Let's get those African voices.
Yes.
So that's, I know that there's an appetite for it. So anyway, to answer your question about how involved am I, it's honestly, it's my baby. Like, already now I know what the set is going to look like for next year. So everything from the beginning, from designing it, from thinking about lineups, it's absolutely, it's my baby.
So you won the South Africa's Comedy Magic Champion for 3 years.
Yeah, that was a while ago.
I know, it's ages ago. But I mean, that was when you...
when I was doing magic.
The magic stuff. But the performance... I mean, they're really, you can do anything when you're on that stage if you're a comedian. You can sing, you can bring on magic, you can do whatever you like.
Okay, let me ask this question, because...
I mean, if you've got the talent, right?
I've got it, and so I've done it. I mean, like, literally, that's how I know Riyad Musa, for example. We went to the College of Magic together.
Yeah.
So we've known each other since we were kids. So I did that since forever, and then sometime in the mid-2000s, I decided, let's leave the magic one side and just stick to the comedy, because that's where there was momentum. How do you... as an audience, reconcile, if this dude who's a comedian and he talks about whatever, race or privilege or all sorts of edgy things, and then now suddenly next thing he goes, and for my next trick, you ma'am, can it work? Could you do both?
Didn't you try? I mean, you did. You used to
I
do both.
I did a little, but I feel like I'm so far removed from that world. The reason I'm asking it is because about 2 weeks ago, I bought a deck of cards. It's like, uh-oh. I feel like I'm missing this
Maybe
thing.
Maybe you need to bring it back. I mean, it is a very different thing, and I mean, you're one of the few people who could probably pull it off. I think it might be difficult to segue between the things, but maybe the audience would love it.
I wonder.
We know people like that stuff.
They do, hey? They do. I mean, you look at these talent shows that are on TV. I always thought, if you just had you need four
good... A lot
good
of them, magicians win a lot of those shows.
Yeah.
And remember, you've also got the ability to be funny about it. So if the trick doesn't work, it's going to be hilarious.
Always, exactly.
If the trick goes
laugh
well,
at my
people
jokes
be,
and be mystified by my magic.
Yes.
Except when it goes wrong, then they laugh at your magic and are mystified by your jokes. That's often what happens in the Eastern Cape.
Shame they really are taking a hammering today. But, Stuart, I mean, do you feel that there's a lot of very new stuff going on in comedy, because I don't see people complaining that it's, you know, same old, because people used to get laughs for the same stuff over and over again. So it would be the race stuff, the, you know, government stuff.
Yes.
There's all those tried and tested things.
Yes.
But these days, I don't see people going for that anymore.
Not at all. You know what? You know what's killed it? I think social media, Twitter,
yeah,
memes.
Yeah.
So... I can come up with the best Trump joke possible.
Mm-hmm.
Trump does whatever now. If he did something right now, and on Friday I come up with an amazing Trump joke, that audience will look at me and be like, we saw 20 memes which are funnier than that.
Exactly. So
if you just followed a Twitter thread,
yeah,
the collective consciousness of Twitter is so funny. It's funnier than any comic there is, honestly, because one just builds on another. So it really does mean that... topical things have become very difficult for comics to talk about, because by the time you want to talk about it this evening, people have been like, yeah, but we saw 20 memes which are way funnier. So what it's made comics do is dig deeper.
Yeah.
And that's amazing. It just then means they go inside and they go, well, okay, cool, let me talk about my lived experience or whatever, and then it becomes quite unique. It becomes not necessarily about black people do this, white people do that, because that as well is I think it feels tired.
It's tired, yeah.
When people do it, I think we just had such and still continue, I guess, to a certain extent, have just like the situation by the powers that be is just it's beyond laughable. No, you know, it used to be we can giggle about it. Now it's just another 19 billion. Do you know what I mean?
I mean, this ESCOM thing.
But there's no humor in it. Mm-mm. You know, you lost 15 million on Sarafina. That was, I could see the joke. I can talk about catering. I can, you know what I mean? When you're talking billions, then you go, guys, we literally are fixing every pothole and every school in this country with 19 billion. So that's it removes your sense.
What's your process when it comes to writing new material? Do you actually sit and, like, do you sit there in your house? What do you do? Where does it happen for you? Do you record while you're driving around? You record ideas on your voice notes?
It's very much a combination of that. So sometimes ideas will pop up, and if you're quick enough, you grab your phone and you record it. It's just an idea that pops up. I try to, often for me, it comes down to, I book theater dates, and I come up with a name for a show. Then I go, right, so I've got 4 months. I need another hour. Go.
What's the
work? Look.
How late can you leave it? Like, if you've got 2 weeks to go, do you start worrying?
Oh yes. No. Then you're having sleepless nights. And there's nothing quite like writing under the gun. But in truth, having said that, I've also kind of changed my approach. I used to write a show and then debut the show.
Yeah.
So I used to work with a director named Heinrich Reisenhoff. In fact, I might work with him again next year. We wrote shows like Technicolored and Learner Husband and Money's Too Tight to Pinch and whatever. And Heinrich went, Stu, don't give away the material. Like, just, we're working on the show, debut a show. But he's a theater director. That's what they do. So we would write shows, and that was scary, because on first night you go, I think this is funny, but I don't know how I'm going to deliver it, because I don't know, you know, the delivery is based on their response. And some things which you think are going to be a giggle gets applause. Some things which you think is going to be, wow, this is where I get to break and have for the applause and drink my water. I was just like, like, whew, okay, time to move on.
That must be such a horrible feeling.
Yes, it is. But as I say, it's kind of, you have the other side as well.
And then suddenly you get the blood to laugh.
Wow, I didn't know that was going to be that bad. So, but that's not how I write anymore. I very much test it in clubs now. I'll take an idea to a club, and I've got, all you need is a kind of funny premise or a kind of funny story, and trust that I know funny. I trust that when I tell people a story, it's going to be funny. I trust that in that moment,
that is hard,
if there's
man.
An audience, jeez. Now here's the thing, I'm going to play with that audience. So if I was talking about the fact that we did a penis transplant, this was the hence me talking about the heart transplant, and now the other major organ, and how they're similar. And then within that moment, if someone does something in the audience, if someone, there's a guy who shuffled in his seat, and then I could play with that. I could be like, you know, you've responded to nothing, but when I said penis transplant, you just opened your legs like you want to donate some, sir. And then that became a thing. Then I was talking to him about whether he would donate and what that would be like, and he's asking his wife for permission.
That kind of
went, and now that is very much a part of what it is.
You have to be so confident to be able to do comedy that way. I mean, I know there are people like you who can. But they're few and far between. I mean, a lot of people have to remember every word. They have to teach themselves the timing they have to do. And they can be very good comedians.
Yep.
So both work.
No, they do. But for me, as I say, it's just now. I think I found that it allows for it to grow organically. Mm. If I take a couple of ideas into a club, and as I said, it's those low pressure situations. I'm not being paid to be here. I'm just kind of popping in and saying, hey, can I get 10 minutes as a guest? And they chuck you on, and they ain't gonna flash you. At 20 minutes, they're not flashing you. They're just going, go, it's fine, just keep going. So we have the luxury of that. It's kind of stalwarts of the industry, that whenever you arrive at the gig, people just go, oh, you can jump on, oh, amazing. And so you can use it to your advantage. I found that's a cool way to develop it. You kind of develop the material organically that way.
You've just you mentioned Grahamstown a minute ago.
Mm.
So you were, funny you should say that, which is Rob Van Vieren, he directed that.
Yeah, he directed
that. So how did that go?
It was cool. I mean, I wrote that as a bit of a work in progress last year.
Yeah.
And I tried it at Grahamstown, and I was like, it feels incomplete. I need an outside perspective. Because the previous show I wrote, I took it to Grahamstown, and I was very disciplined. Yeah. I had an hour and a half material and an hour on stage. So I do it. And the first day I wrote and I'd go home and I was staying in a house with a bunch of comics. And I'd be like, guys, be quiet. I'm working here. And I'd watch myself and I'd change it. And I was very diligent. And the next day I'd go and I'd do a slightly different hour. And by the time I left, I was happy with the show that I had. And I went back the next day and I won the Ovation Award for that show. So I was like, wow, I can direct myself. And then last year when I went with Funny You Should Say That, it was like, oh, I'm going to replicate the thing again. And when I left Grahamstown, I was just like, it feels incomplete. I don't know where I'm going with this. So before it ran at the Baxter in January, I was like, no, let me find an outside voice. And I love Rob. I love his politics. I love... He's crazy. I love his energy he brings.
He is... really, really talented, and he's also a hard worker.
Ooh. Like, I mean, you don't understand. Like, people who you say that because you know it, but people who don't know Rob, I'm like, no, guys, you don't understand.
And a serious guy.
Yes, like, I mean, if you watch his serious plays,
yo,
it's something else. I was watching Dangled. Dangled was
look,
probably one of my favorites.
I wish I could sit through a serious play, but I'd kill myself.
No, this was, you know, this, it was Dangled as a very
even Rob, I mean, if it's not funny, I would, oh, I hate plays, man.
But this was such a short...
He's an artist.
He's an absolute artist. I mean, I watched it, I was like, oh my goodness, I've got to work with this guy. He is something else. I mean, I trust him as a comic. I love his politics. So, yeah, cool.
You said something just now that I thought was very interesting, the stalwarts of the industry. I mean, you have been around a long time, along with these other guys on the Big Five with you now.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a privilege that comes with that? I mean, you can go up on stage in any place in South Africa and they'll be happy to see you.
Yeah.
That's a
massive privilege.
The audience, there's recognition.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
people will buy a ticket just because they see your name.
Yes.
That's another good thing, right? There's obviously an ability for you to get the best jobs. You can sometimes you can pick and choose.
Yes.
Which the comics at the lower end of the spectrum don't always get to do. Are there any negatives to being a stalwart?
If you took yourself too seriously and you believed you have to... I don't want to say if you believed you have to always be at the top of your game, because you must.
You have to, yeah.
You must be at the top of your game. You're only as good as your last gig, so you've got to work at it constantly. I think, if you want to talk about something deadly serious that I think my generation is facing now...
Mm-hmm.
You run the risk of becoming jaded. Because now we are seeing people who started a lot later than us, who are doing things in the world which we are still hoping to do. Mm-hmm. Tumi Morake,
mm-hmm.
off to shoot a Netflix special this weekend.
Yeah. Yes.
So there's you run the risk of going, but I've been, and I should, and I'm way funnier than, I'm so much funnier than Tumi. Why did she get it and I didn't get it? That's the kind of, that might be the negative.
So you have to watch that.
You have to watch that. So for my money, you've got to kind of,
because I remember when Trevor Noah got his gig on American TV.
You saw a
TV.
Lot of bitterness, eh?
Yeah, there was some nasty, and they wouldn't ever say it publicly, but you'd hear the guys talking to each other.
No, but you'd feel it, and you knew it, and you kind of, whenever someone said, oh, but he, and I'd be like, oh, but he, nothing.
Because
you
guys
world.
Are all, listen, the it's amazing, the comedians in South Africa are very supportive of each other.
Right? Generally,
It's mostly a very cool community, and you guys do hang out together,
yes.
and you do all party after your gigs occasionally, and some of you more serious than others, but you all kind of get along. But it's funny, like, if you jump too far ahead of everybody else,
there are some people
who pull
get
you
me
back
wrong.
Yet.
Listen, the problem with Teva was quite simply he's an anomaly, but he's not a South African anomaly. He's a world anomaly.
Yes.
So all the feelings we were catching 10 years ago, those American comics are feeling now. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's terrible being an American comic right now, because you're going, but why are these foreigners coming into our country, taking all our jobs. Absolutely. That's literally, we, you know, everyone was kind of feeling that way about Trevor 10 years ago. Now you just go, I think once he made the move, everyone was just like, whew. But now I can do some corporate gigs, eh? Because they're going to book me again.
But, I mean,
so, but he was such an anomaly. So yeah. I think an anomaly would give rise to what's happening? I mean, you look at someone like Skulk Poseidonote. I love Skulk.
Yeah.
Skulk is one of the hardest working comics
at the moment.
He's just gotten representation in the UK. Mick Perrin, one of the biggest agents in the world, has just signed him. And I have nothing but love and respect for Skulk and support.
Stuart, I mean, comedians say very nice things about each other, but you can hear when they really have respect and admiration. And people like you, I mean, the rest of them really like you. I get them in here all the time because I love comics. I do think they're the cleverest people. And I think they're the social commentators that everybody else in the news wishes they were.
For sure.
You know? And they say nice things about you. And then you put shows like this together, which is going to be a real hit. I mean, I can't imagine people aren't going to line up around the block for this.
We hope so.
The Big Five comedy show. Do any of them say thank you?
They do.
These ungrateful sons of bitches.
No, you know what? What we know about this lineup is the first year we did it. I mean, it was literally a wing and a prayer. I'd booked two nights at Artscape. It's a massive venue, yes. The Opera House.
Sure.
And I just called. I called my friends. I called my very best friend Kurt Skundert was unfortunately not in town on that date, and people always said it was so weird that you never used him. I was like, no, don't get me wrong, he was the first call I made. But I called Barry Hilton. I said, Barry, if I'm going to make this work, I need the biggest stalwart of this industry to be the headliner of the show. There can only be one headliner. I need you to give this brand credibility. And Barry's like, sure, let's do it.
That's amazing.
Loiso Gola was supposed to be on it, but then he got an amazing gig overseas in, he had to do Live at the Apollo, I think it was. And
sure,
so,
that's nice.
And we just went, well, Loy, okay, I guess I'm not announcing you.
That's great.
Riyad Musa ended up doing it, Nick Rabinowitz ended up doing it, Kagiso Lediga ended up doing it. And because it was, I mean, we made quite a big splash without any kind of sponsor. Well, and still, there's no sponsorship attached to that. Literally,
you talk about like
there's a wing and a prayer kind of all the money out of your bond kind of thing.
Do those greedy people at Monte Cassino let you keep concessions, or do they take all of that?
Well, it's a very, very simple thing. I mean, their terms and conditions are quite standard, and you just have to sign the contract. So you.
There's no discussion around that.
No.
You get tickets?
I sell tickets. I pay for the sound and lighting. I pay for all the tick and they get the bums on seats. And also what I love about this brand is that, so like the two feathers in my cap is, I remember I called, when we did the second year, I called Jason Goliath, and he was on holiday in Egypt.
Oh.
I didn't call him. I just said,
now those Goliaths are getting a bit full of themselves, aren't
they? They are on holiday in Egypt and all the rest. So I sent him a WhatsApp. I was like, Jason, we're doing the Big Five on this date in Joburg, and I'd love for you to be a part of the lineup.
But did he get his PA's PA to call you?
He called me from Egypt.
Wow.
He said, my man, I'm not on roaming, but I want to tell you, I don't care what gig is happening. If it's Montreal Comedy Festival, I don't care. I'm cancelling everything.
Nice. He's a good guy.
I haven't
guy,
seen my dad.
What a good guy.
And he's Jason comes up to you after every show and says, oh, thank you so much. Or even Joey. And I know Joey had mad FOMO the first year, because when I called him the second year, he was like, yeah, thanks, man. Okay, yeah. I thought I wasn't on your radio.
You know what's impressive, too, is those Goliaths with what they've done for comedy.
Amazing. Amazing.
And I think a lot of people are very grateful to them for giving the opportunity to other comics.
I was, check this out. So this past weekend, it didn't make a big splash in Joburg, but we did Comedy Con in Cape Town.
Yes.
Which is a big comedy conference.
Yes.
It's a conference of comics.
Oh my God, that must be something. How do you get invited to that?
It's a kind of a bit of an open invitation, and
like the zoo.
It is a bit like a zoo, but they do like amazing discussions. So one discussion was on social media. The next discussion was on media.
Is comics being serious?
No, so they get panelists in to talk to comics.
Oh.
So they're going, guys, listen, you must start treating yourselves like businesses.
Yes.
And the person who put this together was Kate Goliath.
Yeah, she's a
genius. Backbone of the Goliaths.
Yes, sis.
On her, you talk about drinks for the comics, breakfast and lunch for the comics. And that was
because I mean some of the comics haven't had a hot meal since the 90s.
In a while, it's been a while. It's been a while. Really. There was a lot of them packing in muffins. And this was the Goliaths going, yo, we're gonna invest in this industry. We've got to create this.
I love those. But Kate's the real power.
She is the real power. And next year, when there's a massive sponsor attached to it, all the comics are gonna be like, no, we go, because they were the ones who invested their money.
Absolutely.
And what we hope people will feel that way about the Big Five. They'll be like, no, sure. TaylorMade, they put the money in. So when this thing travels to the UK and to Australia and wherever, we're gonna go in.
So TaylorMade is your company.
TaylorMade Productions, that's the one.
So listen, congratulations on putting together an amazing lineup like this. It all happens at Monte Cassino this weekend, 27, 28 July, 8 p.m. Just the best comics in South Africa. Tickets available at CompuTicket. They range from 150 to 300 rand. If you're cheap,
oh,
and you can only afford the 150, you might be able to see with your binoculars from the very top. But if you just part with another 150 and stop being so goddamn mean, then you can sit right up front. 300 rand ticket.
We really tried, and that was the thing. We didn't want anyone to come to the show and say, "I can't, afford it."
No, well, you don't want poor people in your show anyway. It's very depressing if you have poor people in the front row, because you know that. Because they're wearing old clothes and they smell a little bit, and plus you never
haven't had a hot meal.
Yeah, and they're not good. Yeah, plus they might even be comedians. No, listen, it's terrific. This is great, Stuart, and nice to see you again, man. Congrats.
Thank you
on everything that you're doing.
Thanks for the chat, man. Always good to pop in.
Always nice to see you, and we'll catch up. I just got to read this email since we started on East London this morning, and we're going to end on East London. Michelle just sent me an email. This is Michelle Airy. She's got a couple of things to say, so let's listen to this quickly. Hey, Gareth, Brian, who emailed to say that East London is not a dilapidated shithole, clearly has an eyesight or perception problem. Michelle says, I live in East London, and although you can get away with not having to look at that complete ruin if you stick to the outlying coastal suburbs, it is in fact a complete dump. I always say that the city centre looks like there was a civil war in the area, and Mogadishu could not look any worse. The way you described it is as if you were standing there looking at it. The residents need to get over their love of Friesland milkshakes and shamrock pies and face reality. Nobody is working to improve the city, and the people in charge have stolen all the money. The roads are in pieces, the sewage spills into the ocean, and the rubbish is piled up as far as the eye can see. The metro business sector, working hard, sounds about as believable as Bigfoot riding a unicorn over a rainbow to meet his girlfriend the mermaid.
Ooh,
Brian,
wow.
Brian needs to wipe the shit out of his eyes because he is deluded. Maybe he has a head injury caused by being hit in the head by flying litter. Lots of love, Michelle. Well, Michelle, you made my morning. I'm sure you haven't made Brian's. But there we go. Brian, lots of feedback. Thanks for yours. Send me some more whenever you want to, Brian. We love hearing from you. Stuart Taylor, thank you very much. Thank you for joining us this morning. We will see you tomorrow bright and early at 6 in the morning.
This is CliffCentral.com.